Could look at one of the more mystical or transcendent ideas that come out of Pesach. You're all studying something to do with Pesach, right? And you know the basic idea. You know about the going out of Egypt, matzah, chometz. I don't know how new you are. There's an idea in Pesach that, if we understand it correctly, I can almost assure you that you've never heard anything more important in your life than what you'll hear now. Okay? If you hear this idea and understand it, you'll be capable of maintaining inspiration, a level of supernatural inspiration for the rest of your lives. Okay? I'm not exaggerating, if anything I'm understating it. If you want to know how to tap in to an energy in your own personality that you never dreamed you had before, an ecstatic experience of inspiration that can be prolonged forever, then this idea has to be grasped. You want to hear now, right? But there's a condition, and that is that you have to tune yourself into abstraction. When we study anything in the mystical world, and we're not going to make the table levitate over here, we're just going to talk about something a little bit beneath the surface, then the trick is that you have to use the switch of abstraction that you have as a natural gift. If you hear these words in a childish sense, and you take them at face value, then you miss the point completely. The whole idea of the Kabbalistic system is that since the things themselves can't be said in words, so we say them in physical words or even simple analogies. But if a person gets stuck at the level of the analogy, then not only has he missed the point, but he's done terrible damage to himself. And that's a basic idea that we have to understand. The simple example of that would be that, now before we start the subject, we have to understand that the kli, the vessel, the tool that we have to use in our own personalities in order to be able to grasp the subject. When you speak to a human being, so there are two ways you can relate to him. One is you can look at the skin deep level, you can look at the physical piece of meat that carries him around, and the other is you can relate to something inside. To relate to something inside is what you're supposed to do. I'm choosing this example because when you relate to a person, you do it naturally. The trouble is when you relate to anything else in the world, you don't do it. So it takes training to analyze how you use this switch into abstraction and how you then can focus on anything else in the world. For example, when you relate to somebody, someone you love, let's say a friend, a marriage, you have a very deep and intimate relationship with someone. So if you think about it carefully, you'll see that the way the relationship is contracted, the way you predicate, the way you conduct the relationship is very strange. The way you get to know them is only by their physical tissue. That means as long as you know a person, you never see the person inside. You can know someone for 50 years intimately, you never see the human being. You never see more than the tip of his nose. You can't see the person, you can't see the personality. But actually what you want to see and what you want to feel and make contact with is the personality. You're not interested in the piece of steak that carries them around. This generation, of course, doesn't know that. This generation of the world's history does relate to the piece of meat. They strip it naked and sell it like horse meat. That's what's going on out there. They teach you that it's no different than a gorilla's, and they advertise it that way, and that's what they sell, but of course that's not what being human means. But the strange paradox is that in order to get inside a human being, you have to go through the medium of the vessel. Are you with me? For example, let's say somebody, you need something and someone gives it to you. So they put their hand in their pocket, they take out a physical object, they move that object through space and they give it to you. Really what's really happened is no different than a monkey. Some physical tissue, some nerves have sent impulses, the muscles have twitched, physical object has moved through space, no different than if a monkey would do it. But that's the last thing you think about when you relate to that person. What you understand, what you sense, what you're sensitive to, is an act of sensitivity, of generosity, of self-sacrifice. You relate very deeply to the person inside. You ignore the physical structure, is that right? You don't think while the person is doing it of muscles twitching and objects moving and the physics of the exercise. That's just not the way you think about it. You immediately understand that there's a human being inside that's relating to the inner spiritual being inside you. And it's obvious, right? This doesn't even need to be spoken out. Are you with me so far? Which means that you ignore the vessel and you immediately tap in to the abstraction, which is the human being inside, although you never ever see that person. When someone says something to you that's very special, let's say in an intimate relationship, somebody would say something to you that you remember for the rest of your life, that might inspire you for the rest of your life. Actually, what happened there was some muscles of a mouth twitched, a tongue, right? A physical piece of tissue that one day will disintegrate, moved around, no different than an animal's. Some sound waves vibrated through the air, your eardrum, how ridiculous it becomes. A nerve impulse was sent into the brain. That's the physiology of what's happening, but that's not what's important. What's important is the inner experience, but that you'll never see. Are you with me? All you can ever relate to, physically, technically, is the way the vessel operates, but that's meaningless. That's not what you want. So what happens? You have a natural gift that enables you to switch into what we call the pneumius of the thing, to the internal, spiritual, abstract, transcendent dimension. You switch into that automatically, and you sense what's going on, although you never see it. Which is remarkable. It means the only way you ever see another human being is through the medium of the vessel, which is finite and physical, subjected to disintegration. Actually, the body really is just a piece of meat with excrement inside. That's what it is. The Gemara says that if a man is having trouble with a woman, let's say a man is troubled with a Yetzirah, that means he has an illicit attraction to a woman with whom a relationship would be illicit. And he can't get her out of his mind, and it's causing him problems. So what should he do? He should say to himself, she's only a bag of excrement with blood in her mouth. That's what he should say. This thought is not recommended unless the situation is desperate. Okay? But if it becomes desperate, that's what a human being is when you think about it. It's a very, very amazing thing. That's what a person is. Deep in the inside of your own being, you carry your own filth around with you. That's what a human being is. But that vessel, and that's what it's to teach us, that vessel you ignore, and you use your sensitivity to relate to actually what's going on inside, even though you can never see it. Now, when we talk about the Kabbalistic system, that's exactly what's going on, in exactly the same degree. We're talking words that are superficial. The words are no more than the body of a gorilla. Are you with me? What we want to hear inside the words is the power of abstraction that touches something inside that you'll never be able to put your finger on, and you'll never be able to express in words, but your neshama will understand, and you'll know that you've understood. Now, with that introduction, which is a broad overview of the Kabbalistic system, I don't know anything about Kabbalah, by the way. Just telling you what I've heard. You can't trust me when I say that, because all Kabbalists say that they don't know anything about it. I really don't know. But these are the things they say. Now let's use this idea to explore something in Pesach that you'll see is fundamental. If you look at the Pesach experience, you'll see, again, now we want to hear this through the filter of our abstract faculty, right? We want to hear it in its depth. But let's look at it physically. When you look at the Pesach experience, you'll see a remarkable facet of life illustrated by the Pesach experience. You'll see that there was a sequence of events which was incredible elevation, followed by tremendous depression. Let's understand that. And I'm going to try and show you that every experience in life is that way. The moment of ecstasy and elevation is called male. That's when the male seed is put in. And the moment of bringing down into the potential for negativity, that's called female. Let's try and understand this together. All life is that way. Nothing can be born unless it has a mother and a father. And a mother and a father put in two opposite dimensions. The father puts in an experience of ecstatic inspiration that only lasts a second, that's tiny in terms of time and space. The mother takes that seed, are you with me? And she builds it into a reality. But it takes a long time, it takes pain, it takes suffering. It's exactly the opposite of what the male does. All life fits into that paradigm, that tension. The Pesach experience is like this. First, the Jews in Egypt were shown an experience of ecstasy that's impossible to describe. They were shown 10 makas, 10 plagues, during which Mitzrayim, Egypt, was turned upside down. But while that country was being turned upside down, they were given an insight into the spiritual world. But they didn't just see physical events. They actually perceived the root of reality. They saw the transcendent dimension. They experienced it directly. It says by the 10th plague, when Hashem killed the firstborn of Mitzrayim, he did it himself. That means no transcendent emanation, but the root, the cause, the ultimate center of reality itself was in Egypt, and they experienced that. There is no human being until that time had ever experienced such a transcendent, such a voltage. No one had ever experienced that. What happened? They were taken out of Egypt in an incredible moment of inspiration. They were taken through 7 days to the Red Sea in immense, enormous divine protection, which they could actually feel and see. At the sea, I'm not going to go into this in detail, there was another ordeal. The Egyptians, it looked as if they were lost for a moment, and that's because all deliverances have a crisis just before, you know, just when you think you've just overcome, then you get a terrible disappointment. There's the pathway in life, spiritual world. That makes it look like you've for sure finished, and only if you've survived through that. You know, if you want the image, it's a woman's pregnancy. When the pregnancy progresses more and more and more, but when finally just about to be over, there comes an event which is enormous compared to what's been before. I can tell you as a doctor, if you watch that event, you watch a woman in labor, you can't, if you had never seen it before, you would be convinced that she's going through a death experience. There's no question. It's a lethal, painful experience which she looks like she's bleeding to death. And out of that, a child is born. But we'll try and fit this in. Let's get the general overall picture. But after that experience, they were uplifted at the sea as no human being ever had been. So they saw the sea split, and it says that the lowest of the Jews then, that means the person with the least spiritual sensitivity, saw more than any prophet ever saw. You follow what we mean? That means they actually experience the root of reality. And there's no way to begin even to describe that event. But the amazing thing that we have to understand today is this, that right after that event, they were taken through the sea, and what happened next was exactly the opposite. And that's the problem that we have to understand. They were dropped in the desert, were the most difficult experience that ever faced a human being, faced them at that stage. They had to go through 49 days in the desert before they could reach the Sinai experience. Now, the 49 days in the desert, first you have to understand, again, when the Torah talks about a desert, a midbar, it doesn't mean a place of sand. If you're 6 years old and you read Chumash, it means a place where there's lots of sand. But that's irrelevant on a deeper level. It doesn't matter if they walk through sand or they didn't walk through sand. When the Torah says a desert, it means a place where there's no life. It means where there's no water of real life. It means a place of spiritual death. To walk through a desert means that they were led through a place where all the death forces in the world were concentrated. There's no place on earth that had a more intense focusing of all the death forces imaginable. All the impurity, what the mystics call the chitzonim, the outside forces, the negative forces, the death forces, were all concentrated there. If you want any proof of it, all you have to do is see that when they went through the next 48 years in the desert, they faced 10 ordeals, you remember? They faced 10 lethal ordeals in the desert, which they failed. They failed those ordeals. Because those ordeals were a stress, they were a tension in which the world focused all its negativity on the most highest, most elevated of people in order to smash them. And they were so intense that they failed those tests. Let me just give you some idea of this. The Gaon of Vilna says the most incredible thing. If this doesn't... this doesn't excite you, go out and get a job right now. The Gaon says the following thing. That why were there 10 plagues? Listen carefully. Why were there 10 plagues in Egypt? And why were there 10 ordeals in the desert? Why? Because the world was created with 10 sayings. And each of the 10 sayings was counterbalanced by a plague in Egypt and counterbalanced by an experience in the desert. What does this mean? It says this. The Egyptians had accreted, they had concentrated, they had built up shells of impurity on all 10 dimensions of reality. We're not going to go into this in detail, but you know that the world is made of 10 spheres. You know what I'm talking about? 10 mystical dimensions. Are you with me? 10 mystical dimensions in the world build up the world. And mystically they're conceived of as layers or shells one around another. The world was built first with an inner point that has no dimension, the first of the 10 sayings. After that, a shell around that, 10 layers. This is, again, very inaccurate words, but we're just using borrowed terms because there are no words for these things. But there are 10 layers that make up the world. The Egyptians were so negative that they had perverted each of those 10. So in order to cleanse the Egyptian, right, to wipe out the negativity, all 10 dimensions had to be purified. Are you with me? And therefore a plague came, each plague to knock out one dimension of impurity that had been built around the pure center. Are you with me? That's why there were 10. Each one knocked out specifically an area of contamination to repurify the world. That's what happened. The Gaon says you can see this clearly from the fact that when you build up layers around an infinite center, you start from the center, obviously, and you build layers outwardly. But if you wish to cleanse, you must go from the outside in. You have to work in reverse. Isn't that so? You can't get to the center until you peel off the layers. And that's why the plagues, listen to this, the plagues in Egypt went in reverse order, opposite to the sayings that created the world. I don't want you to take any pictures, okay? What? Yes, I know, I discussed it. If you take pictures, I'm stopping. I don't want to put anybody off later. Again, the plagues in Egypt went in reverse order from the sayings of creation. Do you follow me? Because each saying of creation built the world outwardly, so Egypt had to be decontaminated from the outside in. Are you with me? For example, what was the last of the 10 plagues? Killing of the firstborn. What was the first saying that created the world? Bereshis, in the beginning. Because the firstborn is always the concept of new birth, of new beginning. So the 10th plague was killing of the firstborn. The first saying of creation was the newborn, the birth of the world. What was the second last plague? Plague of darkness. What was the second saying of creation? Let there be light. You hear? And the Gaon works through all 10 showing you that the 10 plagues work in reverse order to the sayings of creation. Now, if you think that's bad, if you think that's powerful, intense, what was gathered in the desert outside of Egypt, the mystics say, was the intense negativity of the whole universe. Not just what one country had managed to damage and had now been corrected and cleansed, but all evil was concentrated in the desert. And had they coped with that experience, had they gone through the desert experience and battled each ordeal that they were given and won, the world would have reached its level of perfection. Because Right? Their job was to go out of Egypt, become the Jewish people, battle each dimension of negativity and kill it, so that there's no evil left in the world. If there's no evil left in the world, evil means the veil between us and Hashem. By the way, the word evil and veil in English are the same letters rearranged, and Hebrew is the same thing, because English comes from Hebrew. Ra and Ra'alah, a veil and evil in Hebrew, the same roots, very interesting. Because a veil and evil, the mystics who say that English is constructed this way, but it's another subject. That's another time for another time. Another time. But the veil of evil in the world was meant to be destroyed, and when that's wiped out, there'll be no veil anymore, which means we'll experience reality directly, and that was what the job they were given. So let's understand again, we're not going to go into this aspect in detail, but let's understand what it means. It means that in Egypt, they were shown an incredible level of inspiration, and then they were put in the desert where the only thing that faced them was death. You follow what's going on here? It's a very strange thing. What happened? They then worked their way through 49 days of this difficult experience, enormously difficult experience, and they finally reached the pinnacle of Sinai, where they could reach again the state of incredible divine revelation that they'd had 49 days before. So the question is, we have to understand, what does this process mean? Why are you first given an uplifting experience? They were first given that incredible voltage, then it was taken away and they were dropped in the worst dimension of negativity, and they were to build themselves back again to that same position that they'd been given before. What's going on? So what you're about to hear now is the key of the idea, and this is a key. There's no deeper idea in life that I can think of than this idea. Again, this is what I said in the beginning. Because the process of the creation of the world, the purpose of being here, of anything creative, is as follows. Listen well now. First, you are given an experience of elevation that you don't deserve. You're given a false experience of elevation that you don't deserve. You're given it as a free handout. It's given only to inspire you, but you don't deserve it at all, and it's not yours, and it's not real. As soon as you've just begun to taste that inspiration, it's taken away from you. And as soon as it's taken away, you're dropped in an experience of depression, where you feel no inspiration, and the object of that experience is to fight back to the level that you experienced artificially in the beginning, but this time to make it yours. In other words, this time you build it. First it's given as an artificial, as a gift from the outside, right? In order to inspire you to see what you could be, to give you a taste of that, what your greatness is. Are you with me? And then it's deliberately taken away. Hashem deliberately takes it away and he leaves you with no inspiration, but knowing what you could get to if you worked hard enough. And then you have to work back to that level of inspiration, which takes every ounce of your energy, takes the rest of your life, to get back to what you were given for free, but this time you built it, and therefore this time it's you. When they got back to Sinai after 49 days, they received Torah, but they built that reality. They built themselves into the reality, into an existence, into a dimension that could connect with the source through their own greatness, not as a free handout. Let's try and explore this idea and see, let's try and prove it. You know, the test of Kabbalistic wisdom, if you want to know if what I'm saying is true, if you don't feel it already, if you don't have the sensitivity to love, and you don't feel it already, then you can examine it by a Kabbalistic principle which is called a MS Eret La'atzmo, that the truth is a witness to itself. I'll describe to you some experiences in life, and you'll see that everything in life follows this pattern. You'll not only see it, you'll feel it intimately and you'll know it. And that's how you know it's true. Think about life, you'll see that every phase and every angle and every aspect of living always is an artificial inspiration, and just as you make contact with the inspiration, it's taken away. The mystics say that you can see it at the lowest level of creation. Do you know that medically, every sense modality that we have functions only in its first moment of contact? Do you know that? For example, when you touch something, you only feel the thing as you touch it. Once you're in steady state contact with the thing, you don't feel it anymore. By the way, that's why we rub a thing in order to feel it. Because it's only through change that you can actually sense something. Are you with me? When you hear a sound, after it's first impinged itself on your consciousness, you don't hear the sound anymore. You know, you can live in an enormous noise and not be conscious of it at all. Only a change will alert you to the fact that there's something there. If you see something, you don't see it anymore after a while. And there's also intimate things in the intimate area between husband and wife that it's not suitable for us to go into now. If you think about it yourself, and if you get married in Yitzhak Hashem as soon as possible, those who aren't, be able to understand much more deeply this Kabbalistic area, which is what the mystics call touching and not touching. But we can't go into that in too much detail. Speak to me privately afterwards if you're married. Now, you'll see that that's the way the world works. First, there's a contact with tremendous ecstatic experience of contact, and as soon as the contact's been made, it's taken away from you. You'll see it in all areas, a friendship. The most exciting time of a friendship is just as you're discovering the other individual's personality. Is that right? As you make, I'm talking about today's kind of friendship where nobody means anything, no one's sincere or means anything in the first place. There's no sense of responsibility, commitment. This is a destroyed generation, doesn't have any depth of sincerity or commitments, right? This is a grab what you can right now generation. But anybody who understands what it means to give anything in friendship will know that when you make a new friend, you make a contact, so you have an experience of that personality which powerfully vibrates, resonates with your own personality, and as you get to know them, the emotion wears off. The object, of course, is that it shouldn't be that way. The object is that you're given an exposure to that person's personality in a completely artificial way just to inspire you about what this thing is, and then it's taken away from you so you can build a relationship through giving. The way you build a love relationship is through putting yourself into it. Of course it's taken away. If it's given for free, what are you here for? The whole object of building anything in the world is that you have to build it. But how are you going to build anything unless they show you before what it could be? And unless they inspire you beforehand? Are you with me? The Jews in the desert, the Jews in Egypt, didn't deserve that experience. They hadn't earned it yet. They were given, and that's why it couldn't last. That's why it gets taken away from you. They were slave people. They hadn't come to any spiritual stature through their own effort. But it was necessary to save them at that moment before they were lost. So to save them, I were given that voltage. But as soon as they felt what they could be, it was taken away. Let's examine one or two experiences in life. I think you'll understand what I'm saying. Are you with me so far? Not even a vague nod. Anyway. Is anybody more or less with me? You just sleeping with your eyes open, pretending to be awake, not to offend me? Maybe now's the time to stop. Let's examine some experiences in life. Let's share one together. The Chazal say this. Listen carefully now. You hear well. When a child is unborn, when a child is as yet unborn, it says in the womb there's a light lit above his head, and he learns the whole Torah. What does that mean? It means the child learns the whole of the transcendent wisdom. That means he knows everything there is to know about the world. He knows his own share in it. He knows exactly what his capabilities are and where he could fit in. He understands totally the whole constellation of all his personality factors and what he could bring out in the world. He has total absolute clarity of the whole spiritual structure and how he fits into it. As he's born, it says, there's an emanation of divine power that smites him on the mouth, and he forgets everything he knew. And a child is born into the world as a baby, doesn't know anything. But the obvious question is, what's the point of teaching a child the whole mystical system, the whole of the spiritual world, and then making him forget it? Well, it doesn't make any sense. So the Bala Musa and the Kabbalists say this, a child doesn't forget what he learned as a baby. It's driven into the subconscious. It's not taken away from him. It's a very, very wonderful secret. It means a child is born with locked into him the entire structure of the spiritual world. Only it's driven into his subconscious, so he doesn't actually know that he knows it. The skill of becoming mature is to bring out the spiritual depth. It's not to put it in. You with me? Even the very, very unspiritual secular West knows this idea. You know, the word education in English, it comes from the Latin root educo, which means to lead out. It doesn't mean to put in. It doesn't mean to put in information. It means to lead out what's really inside. The mystics say when you learn something, you don't have information put in. What happens is you're taught to lower a bucket into a deep well and you bring out water that was too deep for you to taste before. But actually it was inside you. Where can you experience this? You can experience it, I'll tell you two applications. When you learn something wonderful that really opens your eyes to something, if you're sensitive, you'll be aware that the experience of learning that thing is not that you learn something new, but it's an experience of recognizing something. Is that right? When you learn something, when someone opens your eyes to something that's wonderful, the way you connect with that experience is not that he taught you something that he put into the computer. The way you connect with the emotion is that you actually recognize something. It's familiar to you, actually. Where is it familiar from? Where did you see it before? You saw it before. It was always locked inside. Another application of this idea for B'nai Yeshiva to know is that when a person's mechadesh a chidush in Torah, when you come up with a chidush in Torah, you learn a piece of Torah and you come up with some new idea in Torah. Well, what a chutzpah. Are you going to create Torah? What is this? You hear me? You learn a piece of Torah, and to you it seems that this and this and this is an idea in Torah. And you write it down, and you publish a sefer, and you have your chidushim, and people study it. What a chutzpah. Who are you, Hashem? How do people do that? Torah is written by Hashem. You come up with a chidush the way you think Torah should be? Yeah. But of course it's correct. Because locked inside is the whole Torah. Of course you can come up with a chidush in Torah. If you learn how to lower that bucket into the well that's your own personality, so you can bring out an aspect of Torah that wasn't in the world before. And it is Hashem's Torah. It's not something you made up. Of course, you have to be a pure vessel. The well has to be pure. The water has to be clean. But if you know how to do it, then you purify the water and you lower the bucket. You bring it out. Of course, you have Torah. Let's take another example. The experience of childhood. A child or a teenager. A child or a teenager experiences life with a voltage that's much larger than life. Is that right? When a child and a teenager, that whole phase of life, experiences the world with an artificial voltage that's not real. You know, many people come to me and they say, people have said to me, you know, I'm 33 years old and I've died inside. People have said to me, both as a doctor and somebody working in the Torah world, I've died inside. I say, what do you mean? They say, well, when I was 18, the world was amazing. I could cry easily. My emotions were very rich and strong. And I had a tremendous apprehension of the world in its richness. And now that I've become 30, and most men go through it when they hit 35, that's when men have a tremendous depression sets in often. Now that I've reached that age, I can't emote. I can't feel anything anymore. I've become sterile. I've become dry inside. So you have to explain to a person when he goes through that that's the way the world's designed. Nothing wrong with him. What he had as a youth, as a child and a teenager, was an artificial uplift to inspire him about life. So that he could realize that he could become something if he spends the next 70 years working on himself, day and night, without stopping. But you have to give him that inspiration in the first place. So then, and as soon as you get mature enough to begin to feel it, and feel it with a connection to maturity, it's taken away. So that now you're left without any inspiration, and now you've got to achieve that thing in reality. Are you with me? That's why you'll see teenagers, children are given a gift of being able to have an artificial belief that they could be anything. You know that? Of course, in our Western society, it's the pathetic version of it is that they're not given anything real to aspire to becoming. So a teenager, he goes to see a movie, let's say. He comes home already in his mind, he's going to be the world's best secret agent. Is that right? And he starts, you know, working out how to draw a gun faster than anybody else and sleep on two chairs with his head on this one, his foot on that one, and who knows what kind of things. Do you follow me? Or he becomes these days inspired to become some kind of mutated tortoise or whatever it is that the youth of this generation is nobly inspired by. That's what they. But that's not the object. The object is for a person to become inspired by his own personality. What he's given that gift of being able to feel that his own life is larger than life, and that he could be anything. Because actually, it's true. Actually, he could be anything. Ein davar oimed bifnei ratzon. Nothing stands in the way of desire. That if he wants to be that, he definitely could be it. But you have to first, a teenager, for example. A teenager gets inspired to a level that's not real. It's unreal. It is real. But in emotional terms, it has an unreal quality to it because I'll share with you another painful experience. Very close to my own heart and experience, and I'm sure to yours. You probably beat me to it, and I'm sure you predicted it already. When a person becomes involved in Yiddishkeit, a person comes to yeshiva, they start getting involved in the Jewish experience. You know the way it goes? First, what you hear is absolutely amazing. Everything you hear is phenomenal. Your eyes are open to things that are unbelievable. Every line of the Gemara opens your eyes in a way that's absolutely indescribable. You hear a certain rabbi, maybe, certain person, certain teacher inspires you enormously. Everything he says is incredible. Suddenly, after a year or so, however long it takes you, 6 months, a year and a half, you find yourself sitting in the Beis Medrash and it becomes very hard going. Each line of the Gemara is not inspiring. Not inspiring at all. Very hard work. Each line of the Gemara is harder than the one before. There's no natural inspiration anymore. And people get depressed. I remember once standing at a chasana here in Yerushalayim, after I'd been here in Osama for 2 years. And I was standing next to a certain rabbi from South Africa, Mashokin, who himself went through this process 30 years ago. Today's Rosh Yeshiva, one of the biggest yeshivas in the world, Rosh Kolel. He said to me, how's it going in yeshiva? So I said, you know, Mashokin, I have to confide in you. It's very, very hard. I said, in the beginning, I didn't know the secret yet. I said to him, in the beginning, everything I heard was amazing. Every line of Gemara was an unbelievable inspiration. I've been sitting here in Osama Mech, it's a wonderful place. I must tell you, it's very uninspiring. Every line of the Gemara, every day, it's very, very hard work. So he smiled at me and he said, I see you're in phase two. That's what he said. Huh? So then I began to understand. That's what happens. They take away from you the artificial inspiration, and the only inspiration you're going to merit from then on in is what you build. But then it'll be yours. What they gave you in the beginning is ethereal, it's ephemeral, it goes. What you build inspiration, and of course the trick, I'm sure you already predicted and I'm sure you're ahead of me already, the trick is to maintain the inspiration without letting the dip happen. That's the trick. The trick is to know the secret first, hold on the level of inspiration, and as the natural inspiration starts to die, to start putting your own work in, you follow me, to the extent that you build your own inspiration in a much more real way before you ever, you need never go through the depression. If you know the secret, and you know the warning signs, and as you start to feel that the learning's becoming dull, life's becoming dull, friendships, new experiences, something is missing, you start to build the quality of maturity that actually makes a kinyan on those things, and you actually make them part of you, and so you never need, and it's a much bigger thrill. It's what's called the woman's thrill, it's what's called the female ecstasy, not the male ecstasy, it's the ecstasy of building something real, not the flash of inspiration that's put in the beginning, but it's more real and it lasts and it's yours. I don't know if you're with me, are you with me exactly? This is the Torah sin of wasting semen, wasting seed. Did you realize I was talking about that? The sin, the avera of wasting male seed, is because of this. It means to experience the ecstasy of a moment of creation, but to let that creative energy, that's an ecstatic experience that comes from a world that's hidden, to let it be, to blast it out into the world and let it die. That's the mystical reason why that is such a problem. Every drop, every ounce of a man's energy has to be mated to a woman, whatever that woman is, we'll discuss this a bit more if we get time, which has to bring that to fruition so that it lives in the world. Are you with me? That's what marriage, that's why unmarried you can't achieve this. Unmarried you cannot achieve this experience. Because unless you have the capability, the kli, the vessel, that creature, which is a woman, in every sense, to bring out a man's flesh of inspiration into reality, whether you can't do it. You have to develop that in your own personality and you have to get married as soon as possible when it's correct for you. That's the mystical basis of this idea. The experience in Egypt was a male moment of yesh me'ayin, something from nothing. That spiritual injection, you know, that injection of a spiritual flame, which lasts only for a second but has the seed of everything in it. Then it gets passed over to the woman who takes that seed and she builds it and that goes slowly. Are you with me? That's always the tension between, by the way, if you want to understand, in marriage, that is the way marriage works. The male dimension, always, personality-wise, is the putting in of an energy, a flash of inspiration, and the woman doesn't make her flash of inspiration. She takes it from her husband, but then she stays with it. She has all the opposite qualities to a male. Takes time, takes loyalty, takes pain, takes suffering. She builds, builds, builds. In the end, she builds something real. That's exactly how the parallel works. And you have to maintain the relationship between the two. You have to become ultimately male to be able to generate that spark. And then you have to learn how to be a female or how to find a female such that that spark can be built into reality in the world. Let's just take one more example and then maybe we'll leave it there, or if you're interested to go deeper, we can try and go deeper. The example that I think we should, I'm sure you can, with the next, if you spend a few weeks of deep thinking about this subject, you'll see that it begins to appear everywhere, as I said it would. But an idea that I'll just crystallize, let's crystallize together, where you'll see hardly more important anything could be than this idea, is you'll see that this idea applies classically in marriage. Let's try and understand it together. Marriage is an experience where you meet a woman and you have an experience with a woman, and the way it goes is in two phases. The first experience is an uplift of ecstasy that's indescribable, but just as you begin to feel the inspiration of that experience, it gets taken away. That's what happens. The first phase we call romance. The second phase we call love. Understand? By the way, you know in Hebrew there's no word for romance. You know that? In the Torah language there's no word for romance. Because in Torah there's only a word for that which is real. Because if the word exists, the thing exists. Because a davar in Hebrew, which means a word, is a davar, which means an object or a thing, a phenomenon. So if there's a word for the thing exists. If the thing is artificial, there can't be a word for it. In Hebrew there's no word for romance, only for love. Because the experience of romance, that initial flash of inspiration, it's a fake, that experience. You follow me? Nothing's a fake in Hashem's world. It's there for a reason. It's very, very, very beautiful, but you have to understand what it means. In terms of today's discussion, it's a fake experience. It's given to inspire the couple about what they could be together, and it helps them survive the phase when the crash happens, and it happens always. If you want to know, it happens on the second day of marriage, if you want to know. In case you thought it happens after 15 years of marriage, it happens on the second day of marriage, if you're lucky. Well, that's the way it goes. In the secular world, it's a much bigger mess. I'm not going to talk about that. In the secular world, it's a horrendous mess. People live together before marriage. It complicates the picture. It's another discussion. It's not for B'nai Yeshiva. Discuss it another time. But in the Yeshiva world, the way marriage works is that there's an explosion of emotion at the time when you meet and start to relate to this woman is to become your wife. And the beginning, the phase one, which is the getting to know the person and the early phase of marriage, which if you're lucky lasts a day or two, if you're lucky, maybe it's 7 days if you're one of the gifted few in the world. Then that experience is an unbelievable ecstasy. No words to describe it. You couldn't find the words to put it in if you wanted. But as soon as you've just begun to feel that ecstasy, it gets taken away. And how many people come and say to me and to lots of people, I married the wrong woman. I've got something urgent to discuss with you. This is the way the conversation goes. I've got something urgent to discuss with you. He closes the door, he sits down, he's shaking and sweating. And he says to me, listen, I don't know what to do. I've married the wrong woman. So I say to him, what's the problem? Look, when I went out, when I, you know, on the shidduch, when I spoke, when I, you know, it was fantastic. I mean, she's the most fantastic woman. And so, but right now, you know, it's the wrong woman. I mean, I don't feel anything for her. The whole thing's died. It's dead. It's absolutely terrible. You know, just so explain to such a person. That's the way marriage is designed. That's not him marry the wrong woman. That's the way marriage is designed. First, there's an uplift that's called romance. It's a whirlwind of emotions that they don't deserve at all. What did you put into this relationship? Why do you deserve this? You didn't put anything into it. What have you given yet? What have you sunk into this? What have you contributed to this relationship? What have you built? You haven't built anything. But Hashem gives you an incredible, after all, what is exciting you about this person? Sell us a piece of steak. What is exciting you about this woman? So she smells a little different than you. You follow? Here it's slightly different lengths. You've got curves in different places than you have. What exactly is exciting about this thing? Are you with me? It's also a bag of excrement, like you are. Well, let's face it. Well, doesn't matter. Hashem makes her seem heaven, ecstasy. But after you get to know the heavenly, ecstatic experience, you begin to realize there's a human being in there, just like me. And when you realize that, the emotion goes out of it. And it's a terrible, terrible experience. Terrible experience for people who don't know the secret. And the reason we don't know the secret is because the Western world teaches only the quick fix, ecstatic experience, and it doesn't teach the experience of love. The experience of love that comes after the experience of romance is an experience of work and giving. And that the West doesn't like. You follow me? Western culture doesn't like it. That's hard work and that's painful. The way you get back to the same ecstasy, hear me well, the way you get back to the same ecstasy with your wife that you experienced in the first 2 days of marriage, that takes 35 years of hard work to get back there. That takes 35 years of hard work until you experience that ecstasy. But when you experience that, it's an emotion of having given yourself to her. That's the only way you achieve that love. It's not just giving a lot. It's giving everything that you are to that individual. You have to see yourself there. The work of giving yourself for years and years and years, completely selflessly, into where that person is. So that your life energy is there, not with you. That generates love. That's an ecstasy that's indescribable. Well, that takes 35 years of intense giving. Are you with me? The West doesn't tell you that. The way you brought up in Western culture, the way we brought up, is that that's not the way the world works. The way the world works is a thing called romance, and it lasts forever and ever. That's the way they teach you. So they portray, they don't portray love, do they portray, yeah? Did you ever go to a romance movie, or a read a romantic novel, where what they portray is 35 years of drudgery of giving to each other, you know, through thick and thin? That's not what, you know, the way they portray it is, you know, here she is, this young thing on a Caribbean cruise, and as she comes up on the deck, there she sees this thing in their starched white uniform with a few blonde curls at the base of his neck, a dimple in his chin, you know, and the bells ring and the music plays. You know, that's what happens, right? Yeah? And then, if you read carefully, you'll see the novel about 2 pages later ends. That's like the end of the movie, end of it, because I promise you, 35 years later, when she comes up on deck, there's no bells ringing and music playing. I can assure you that. 1 week later, there's no bells ringing and music playing, I can assure you. But they don't tell you that. All they tell you, so what you train to believe is that this is an artificial gift of an experience that should last forever. And it doesn't last forever. So a month later, when it crashes, you think you married the wrong woman. You think that the guy next door is having this music playing and bells ringing every time he sees his wife. But I can promise you, it's much worse next door than by you. No question about it. So this is a deep secret of Jewish living a person has to understand. You understand this secret is nothing more wonderful in the world. And what a person should want is to get over that experience of artificiality. Because that's not the real thing. You should use it to become inspired. You use what Hashem gives you. And you use that incredible inspiration as a Avodah to Hashem, that He gave you this incredible uplift, that He made the world have that incredible voltage in it. And then you take that energy and that voltage, and you start applying it to the relationship, which means that you start creating and giving, and you start to build that thing again, but this time through your own energy. I don't want to keep talking, and, you know, I mean, I think that's enough. If you have any, maybe, questions, or... There's a deeper angle to this thing, but I don't know how long you've got the patience to sit for. Maybe if anybody wants to leave, I'm not offended, they could leave, and those who want to stay on. You have to be someplace at 3 o'clock? Yeah. Right, let me just, hold on a second, okay? Let's look at an angle. Let's look at this idea on a much deeper level. Now, it's much harder to express, okay? You have to stay with me carefully now. What we just said could vaguely be put into words. Again, you won't experience it in the words. You'll only experience it in your own inner wisdom, your own inner connection with life. You'll be able to understand that what I said is 100% true. That I didn't make it up, I can assure you. Just said over what my Rebbe said to me. But you'll experience that as true. What we have to say now is much more difficult, but let's try and work it out together. You see, you learn this from the Pesach experience at a much deeper level. The Pesach experience is like this. The time when we moved out of Mitzrayim, out of Egypt, was the moment of male ecstasy, as I've tried to explain. Okay? Then the desert experience was the painful female aspect of building reality. But that moment of conception, that moment when a seed is put in, right, when the conception occurs, that moment we have to focus in on Pesach. Let's try and understand this together. In the mystical writings, it says that the first night of Pesach, now just after Maariv, when you make a Seder, is a moment that is so high spiritually that the year never achieves that any other time. Let's understand. It's a moment of conception, of creation, so powerful. I'll tell you the way the mystics put it. I don't pretend to understand it. I'll just share with you the words. Don't ask me any questions. They say that the spiritual world is built by the davening and the mitzvahs that we do. When you daven, when you say prayer, davening and mitzvahs build the spiritual world. And if it wouldn't be that you'd build the spiritual world every evening and every morning, every afternoon, it wouldn't be built, it would crash. So your davening, your ma'ariv, your mitzvahs build the spiritual world. The night of Pesach is so high, it's called Leil Shimurim, it's a night that is so high that our mitzvahs can't even connect with it. The davening that we do on that night, and the Seder, and the mitzvahs, and the halal, and everything we say on Pesach, that night is so intense that it's been built automatically in the spiritual world. It's been built by itself. This is one of the reasons we say halal afterwards. Ma'ariv, some people do, we say, why do we then do mitzvahs? Why do we daven ma'ariv? You know, there's many things you don't have to do. You don't say certain verses, sukkim of protection, you can leave the door unlocked. There's many things you can do that night that you shouldn't do any other night. Because it's a night of such transcendent power that the spiritual world glows, shines automatically without our input. And that's what it says. Don't ask me what it means for another time. Why do we do mitzvahs? Why do we do a seder? Why do we daven? Why do we do the mitzvahs on Pesach night if it's built automatically? To connect ourselves with the energies. You hear that? On every other night of the year, when we do the mitzvah, it's a very deep Kabbalistic idea. When we do the mitzvah or we daven, we build that spiritual reality. On Pesach, it's built automatically, and all we do is open ourselves spiritually so we can draw down the energy. Are you with me? What does it do when you draw down the energy? It lifts you to that level of creation. Again, it means that if you wish to, on the first night of Pesach, you can leap to a level that transcends your natural abilities as high as you want. If you want to, you can leap up on that night to an attainment of spiritual power that you never could any other time of the year. You can make decisions on that night, and you can gear yourself into a spiritual level, in Torah learning, in your relationships, in personality development, in whatever you want. You can leap. You can have in Pesach. You know that a strange phenomenon, I'm sure after what we've discussed up to now, will make it, with just a little effort to understand an abstract idea, I'm sure it will be understand it clearly. You have to try hard now. You'll notice that Pesach is all about hurry. Yes? It all goes around the concept of a rush in time. You understand? It says that we had to leave Egypt in a hurry. Is that right? So fast that the bread couldn't rise. It got baked into matzahs. That was in a rush, a great speed. It wasn't for fear of the Egyptians. They were smashed by them. There was some reason we had to leave at a great pace. Matzah, for example, is a question of time. It has to be hit fast, baked fast, right, before there's time for certain events to happen. The whole concept of Pesach is that there has to be, what are we talking about? We're talking about riding the wave of the flash of inspiration before it has time to expand into the world. Try and understand this. There's one of the great mystics who lived in Yerushalayim, came to Yerushalayim, died about 70 years ago here. He puts it this way. He says that, you know, it says that we were on the 49th level of impurity in Egypt. You know that? Memtesh Haretumah. We were on the 49th level of impurity. Are you familiar with that idea? One more moment we would have been lost. One more moment in Egypt we would have sunk into the spiritual contamination of Egypt. We would have been lost. So the mystics ask the question, it's not only a mystical question, it should strike you. This question we should have thought of. How can you say that one more moment in Egypt would have caused us to be lost? This is a Gemara question now, okay? Before we get to the mystical side, let's understand the question. I'm not going to enjoy the answer unless you hear the question. What does it mean that one more moment in Egypt and we would have been lost spiritually? Do you know what that last night, what are we talking about one more moment, one more minute, one more hour on the night of Marcus Bucharis? We're talking about one more minute of the night when the Egyptians were being killed after 10 plagues had revealed the spiritual reality. You hear me? One more minute of that we would have lost in spiritual contamination? It's a very difficult question. Listen carefully. If you would have told me that one more hour of slavery, let's say the months before the plagues began, where we were smashed by the slavery, one more hour of slavery would have smashed us and caused, I would understand. But to tell me that one more minute at the last minute would have damaged me? One more minute when Hashem was revealing himself in Egypt? One more minute of that we would have exploded spiritually? What do you mean lost in contamination? Do you hear the question? Do you hear the problem? It's a very difficult idea. What does it mean in the mystical writings, in Arizal? In the mystical writings, that one more moment in Egypt we would have caused us to be lost. Adarab, on the contrary. There are even mystics who say that one more moment in Egypt we would have blasted out of reality. One more moment in Egypt, one more moment of exposure to that voltage would have lifted us out of the physical world. Would have brought the messianic perfection instantaneously. And that we couldn't have, because we didn't deserve it. We hadn't built it for ourselves. So Hashem rushed us up before we blasted out of that level. That's the idea. Not that we would have been lost down, we would have been lost up. That's what he explains. Amazing thing. But that's not the line I want to take today. But I'm just, the question you hear, are you with me? The question is, what do you mean we would have been lost? Where would we have been lost had it taken us another minute? So the answer is this. Very, very, very wonderful answer, thing to understand. What would have killed us, what would have caused us to be lost spiritually is this. Had we remained one more minute in Egypt, had we gone out of there slowly, you know what would have killed us? Time. The fact that we moved slowly would have killed us. To understand. We were born as a people, right? We were formed. We came out of the womb, out of Egypt. That's the moment we were conceived as a people or born as a people. We were born as a transcendent people. We were born as a people that lives always at that flash of male inspiration, the moment of conception. We live above physical reality. Are you with me? Completely out of the female dimension. Is anybody with me? And therefore, our conception had to be like that. Had we been formed slowly, like any other nation, by the grinding away of the wheels of time, so we would have been a people subject to time like they all are. But we became what we are in a moment of transcendence. Do you follow me? We became what we became in a moment so ethereal, so close to the passing of the seed, that that's what we became, and we forever lived there. So we're not subject to the rules of time. You'll see it throughout Jewish history, by the way. Who is the first Jewish child? Yitzchak. Avraham Avinu made himself into what we are. His first son, Yitzchak. Before he went to build the Jewish people, which is Yaakov, what was the last experience that he experienced before that? He was killed. He was offered up as a sacrifice on the Mizbeach. He started his family after... We start where death ends. You follow? We start where despair ends. That's the Jewish people. You follow me? We live in that moment of conception. We never came down into the time dimension. And that's the moment, had we gone out of Egypt any more slowly, we would have been in the natural world. We had to be born in the supernatural world. The supernatural world, the moment of conception, is not subject to any contamination. The mystics say that the Yetzirah, your own negativity, cannot get a hold of you in the moment of conception. Only once the flash of energy, of ecstasy, of inspiration has settled down into its details, then the negativity starts to take a hold and pull it down into death. But the moment that it forms itself is too high for the Yetzirah, for negativity to take a hold of. Are you with me? And that's what we had to beat. We had to go out of there so fast that the negativity couldn't take hold. Let's try and explore together, you'll see. Matzah, for example. That's why matzah. What's the difference between matzah and chometz? 2 seconds. Is that right? Do you hear a mitzvah like that? The difference between it's not the difference between beef and pork. It's the difference between the same stuff that you leave 2 seconds longer and it's spiritual death. The difference between matzah and chometz is that matzah is a mitzvah essay that can take you into the highest transcendent world if you eat it. Had that dough been left for 2 seconds longer, not more than the statutory infinite, right, the shear, so then it becomes what's called chometz. If you eat that, it's chorus, spiritual death. That bears thinking about, right? The same thing, 2 seconds later, one side is a mitzvah that rockets you into the spiritual world, the other side kills you spiritually. Just time? Exactly. If you allow yourself to stretch out into the finite dimension, you kill yourself. If a Jew lives in the natural, that means you let your life, experience your life. You're here today because you were here yesterday. That's not called living, that's called rolling on towards death. You have to be here today because you reformed yourself today. You have to give birth to yourself today. Every day at least. Avraham Avinu used to do it every second. Every second of his life was a new creation. But at least every night when you go to bed, you've got to sit on your bed and say to yourself, what did I do today and what am I going to do? And you've got to wake up tomorrow rocket powered. That's what it has to be. The mystics explain this as a Zohar that says, the mystics explain the difference in chometz and matzah. If you take the letters of chometz and matzah, you'll see they're exactly the same letters, except matzah has a hay in it and chometz has a ches. It's the only difference. What's the difference between a hay and a ches? The tiniest drop of ink. That's all. Is that right? A hay is open and a ches is closed. That means, again, the same idea. Take matzah, add one tiny dimension of the physical world, and you killed yourself. That's chometz. That means the idea of Pesach in the springtime when the shoots come through the ground, going out of Egypt in a hurry, the matzah that's baked in a hurry, the idea is to learn how to live in the spiritual world at that moment of male ecstasy, the moment of male conception, before you bring yourself down into the finite world. I'll give you just one example and we'll leave it at that. The male dimension, and that's what forms us as a Jewish people, is that spark, that point of infinity. The female dimension that builds reality is called not a point but a circle. Do you know that? The mystical shape of a woman is called a circle. It's one of the reasons we give a ring. It's one of the reasons why the bride walks around the groom. The symbol of a woman is a perfect circle. the woman's letter is a samach, the letter of a perfect circle. So the mystics say this, that a circle is a symbol of perfection. It's the only shape that has, that obeys certain rules of geometry. I'll explain to you in a moment. And it's the letter of contamination and death. It's the letter of the sotan, of the force of negativity. Why? Because the danger of the circle is the fact that, do you know that the circle is the only shape known to man where if you take the parameters of any tiny piece of the circle and you carry on, you'll have a perfect circle, you'll get back to where you began. The whole thing is predictable from the beginning. Is that correct? You take an arc of a circle, no matter how small, and you continue the same conditions that you have, you'll eventually have a perfect circle and you'll keep going around. There's no other shape that does that. Straight line, who knows where it will end. Irregular shape, who knows where the next bend will be. Are you with me? A circle is the only shape where the part is the same, makes no difference, the same as the whole. There's no end, there's no beginning, and any part will immediately predict from the tiniest beginning. As soon as it's not, listen well, if you start making a circle, when you put a dot down, that's an infinite dot, could be anything. As soon as you expand out of infinity and you give it any dimension, and you start that arc, immediately you've closed the circle, makes no difference. Now, for sure now you're going to get back to the beginning. Do you follow me? That's the danger of a woman. That's the beauty of a woman, is that she can take an infinite spark and make it whole and beautiful. And the danger, she can freeze it so it just keeps going on and on and on until it winds down. You follow me? That's why a woman has to have the skill of taking a husband. A Jewish woman's skill is to take a husband and not freeze him solid. It's to extract every ounce of energy and give it forth as life. She doesn't take a seed from a man and hold it as a seed. She fans it into a flame and she builds and builds and builds. And when it's ready to be a human life, she lets it tear away from her in pain and danger. That's the greatness of a woman. But she has to know how to do that. You follow me? The danger of a woman is that she can freeze it solid. Now, these are very deep ideas. And therefore, the letter, the mark of perfection, of spiritual, of infinity, is the infinite speck, and the letter of death is a perfect circle. Death and duty, both powers in the same thing. Do you know that the whole of the description of Genesis, you better hold on to your chair for this, the whole description of Genesis, the whole description of the creation of the world, has no samach in it at all. Did you know that? Read through Chumash, you'll find that from the beginning of Bereshit until the creation of woman, that he formed the flesh of woman, is the first samach in the Chumash. You know that? The mystics ask, it says, it talks about the rivers in Gan Eden, there are two samachs over there, the mystics explain why those are there. But the first samach in the Medrash, but the first samach in Chumash appears only where woman appears. Until then, you've had no continuity, it's all flesh of creation. There's one other parasha in the Torah, by the way. There's one other parasha in the Torah that has no samach in the whole parasha. You know what that is? The parasha of Bechor, of firstborn. The parasha of the firstborn, the spark of new birth. That whole parasha doesn't have a single samach. You try to write a page of English prose without an S. Huh? In case you think somebody just lacked on that by accident. You follow me? That whole parasha doesn't have a samach. Because the samach is the letter of continuity. And that's exactly the thing. And therefore, that's what it means. The object of living is to be able to continue. Each spark of the circle has to be a new spark. Not because the previous one defined where you're going now. Every moment of life has to be. A simple illustration practically would be the Balei Musa say, I'll give you an example. The Balei Musa say, how do you beat the Yetzer Hara? So you act before he can act. Because if you act with your first flash of inspiration, he can't take a hold of you. Are you with me? As you are inspired, if you act with that inspiration, he can't get a hold of you. Because he can only take a hold of you where you've expanded into the finite dimension. I'll give you a crude example. Crude example. We'll finish with this. It's 6 o'clock in the morning, and you wake up and it's cold outside and you're about to get out of bed. Just as you're about to do so, a voice speaks in your head and says, whoa, not so fast. So it's really cold out there. So you say yes. He says to you, well, now just think about this. 1 second. Don't be so hasty. 1 minute. If you spend another hour in bed, sure you're going to miss an hour of the day. No question. But you know how fresh you're going to be for the rest of the day? You know what energy you're going to have? Then you say, no, 1 second. I'll get up now. I'll have a strong coffee. I'll splash my face with cold water. And no, he says to you, 1 second, not so fast. Another hour in this bed here, you're going to be a powerhouse for this. Not you're going to achieve. So the Balaam wants to say this. Once he's speaking to you, you've lost. You've finished. Once he's already talking to you, follow me. You had it, you finished. How do you handle that situation? As you open your eyes, leap out of bed. Okay? That's why, if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, you look in the Code of Jewish Law, the manual of Jewish spiritual development, the first statement is, right? You should arise in the morning like a lion to serve Hashem. What kind of spiritual document tells you to get up in the morning? Did you ever see a Zen manual or some spiritual, I'm not knocking other people's religion, but did you ever see any spiritual system where the first instruction is to get out of bed in the morning? What it means is, it doesn't mean get out of bed. It means that as your consciousness arrives, as you enter consciousness, immediately form yourself in that phase. If you form yourself in the second phase, you follow me, then you're subject to the rules of physicality. You hear it. And that's why you have to be able to do that. And therefore, that's exactly what you see in phase. In many illustrations you see, you permit me one more illustration, very briefly, one more illustration. You see that it says that in all the plagues that happen in Egypt, the forces, the Khatumim, the sorcerers in Egypt, were able to reproduce the same, you know, they could turn the water to blood also. They could turn their sticks into snakes also. There was no big deal for them. When Moshe Rabbeinu did his thing, they could equal the same tricks. There's one that they couldn't equal, and that was Kini. Kini, lice. Yeah, that they couldn't do. Why not? That's a big thing about lice. They could turn water to blood. They could turn a piece of wood into a snake. That's not bad. They couldn't create lice. So you know what it says? It says this. Lice are too small. Our lice are too small. What does that mean? That the minimum shear, the minimum size for the spiritual negativity of witchcraft, whatever that is, to take effect, is an adasha. An adasha is like a barley grain. A grain of barley, let's say. Smaller than that, contamination can't take effect, can't take a hold. It has to be bigger than that. You follow me? Lice are too small. Since they were drawing down power from the evil side, they were creating all the things they were creating with black energy, with evil forces. So they could only attach their power to things that were subject to being subject to evil. But things that are too small, what's the idea? Because when you approach infinity, when you get small enough or quick enough, so then you reach the spiritual dimension. Even while you're physical. You follow me? More than 18 minutes, chometz, it's death. Less than 18 minutes, you're in the spiritual world, it's spiritual life. You follow me? Go out of Egypt slowly. One more minute in Egypt, we would have been lost, dead, finished. Not contaminated by Egypt, but lost by physicality. We would have expanded into time. That's not what a Jew is. Go out of Egypt fast. Form ourselves as a people who are always at that male level of energy, sparking out inspiration. That's where we function. So that is the thing that we have to understand today. That life consists, very briefly, in summary, as follows. There are two phases. There's a phase of energy, unbelievable inspiration, and then the phase of hard work of building. The trick of being a Jew is to take the level of inspiration and maintain it in the level of building. To take a marriage, take the romance of a marriage, and inspire the marriage with that romance, so that for the next 35 years, it sparks along from energy to energy while building itself in reality. Do you hear what a wonderful task that is in life, in the world? You know what it is to be able to build such a thing in the world? Or a person builds himself in Torah. To take the energy of his first contact with the Chiddush, when he understands something for the first time, when his eyes are open to something in the spiritual world, to sail off above the ground with that energy, and build the next level as he works it through and works on it and builds the next thing, to build it into his personality with the same inspiration, but with the hard work that it takes.